To badquaker.com podcast. Today is Wednesday, April 11th, 2012. This is podcast number 131, and my name is Ben Stone. And today, I'm going to pick up on there's a three-part series that I did on the inevitability of the police state. And I don't know if I'll label this as episode four or as part four of that series, or if I'll just make some comments in regards to that series and kind of play up on it. I'm not really sure. We'll see how it goes. I do have something I need to let you know. First off, my voice is coming and going today. I've got just crazy sinus problems with all the pollen that's just burst onto the scene here in Western Ohio. And so my sinuses are draining, my throat's really sore, and I'm stopping constantly to have a drink of water. So I'm going to try to edit out the throat clearing and the water chugging, but I'll do the best I can with that. And hopefully my voice will make it through the whole podcast. So now, and I should mention, the whole time I was setting up the computer and the microphones and everything, Baggy the cat has been running in here going crazy, her big old fluffy tail popping around. So it's very likely, this is a daytime podcast today, so I'm actually recording it on Tuesday afternoon. We're likely to get a lot of background noise, maybe dogs barking, cars, trucks, mailmen. Who knows? So, off we go, and we'll see how it goes. There's one of these
an internet poster floating around on Facebook and other places where it says some things. It's basically a pro Ron Paul poster, and it says something or other, and then it says, "What part of the Constitution is it that you don't like?" So it's basically presenting the question, if you don't like Ron Paul, you know, why don't you like the Constitution? It's making that leap. And I'm not going to attack any logical fallacies that might be associated with that. What I do want to point out is, I just want to answer this question. It's a simple question. What part of the Constitution is it that you don't like? And just to answer it quickly, I would say, the premise of the Constitution, the idea that you would have a group of people get together and make the decision for everybody else who didn't even know that they were meeting at the time, and form a federal government and claim that they were doing so on behalf of the people, and then inflict that federal government upon them, even though they had just fought a long, bloody war to get out from underneath a very similar government. The premise of the Constitution would be the part of the Constitution that I like the least. But now, in addition to that, and I've done this a few times on the podcast here, let me just read the preamble to you here. Oh, well, no, let me go back, because I mentioned something, and it might be a shock to a lot of people. War against the British for our independence. I don't call it a revolution. It's not a revolutionary war because it wasn't a revolution. We were not attempting to conquer London and take over the government of, you know, we weren't attempting to throw out Parliament or unseat the king. So it was not a true revolution. We were separating ourselves from a foreign country that was usurping its power over us. So it wasn't a true revolution. It was a war of independence. But then in addition to that, once the War of Independence was won, there was a Confederacy government, the Articles of Confederation, which was a loose association of independent states. And there was a problem with that in the sense that the bankers, first off, and this is a little bit of a history lesson here, I hadn't even planned on going into this, but everything that I'm saying can be backed up by a number of sources. The first of which always pops to mind is Murray Rothbard's wonderful work, Conceived in Liberty, where it goes into great detail on all of this with all the documentation and everything. So I'm not just making this up off the top of my head like high school teachers do. But after the War of Independence, the Articles of Confederation were actually functioning perfectly well. The only problem, the only real problem with the Articles of Confederation was that during the war, Hamilton, being Washington's aide, and Hamilton being closely associated with a number of very powerful New York bankers and Boston bankers, Hamilton made arrangements with Washington so that he could get financing, and they pushed this through the Continental Congress, but part of it didn't even go through the Continental Congress. But Washington used his influence, being influenced by Hamilton and guided by Hamilton, to take out these massive loans from these New York and Boston banks. Now, a huge amount of money was borrowed, and this was borrowed so that Washington could march his men up and down in fields and pretend like they were proper European armies, so that Washington could hire guys like the so-called Baron von Steuben, who was not a baron, and it was the his title was fake, and he came over with the purpose of teaching the new American army how to behave like European armies. The problem is, Washington. Let's look at it this way. First off, Washington's track record was not so great, despite what you've been told by high school and even, you know, what they teach in military schools and all these kind of things. Washington was not a great general. Washington was really good at retreating, at moving back, at pulling back, at getting into a little bit of skirmish and then pulling away immediately. He had the one great victory where in the middle of the night they used what might be called commando tactics or what might be called guerrilla warfare. It's not really guerrilla warfare, though. More like commando tactics, where they went across the frozen river, attacked the Hessians on a holiday night, and it was a surprise attack in the middle of the night, and they did very well. But the regular army of British troops was right down the road. They could have had them as well, and Washington panicked and pulled out. Rather than having a complete victory, he only had half a victory and ran away. And that's his big accomplishment in the war. The rest of the time, any other accomplishments that Washington was involved with, you can accredit those to Lafayette, not Washington. The rest of the time, Washington drilled his men, punished his men severely, ran off his best men. His best men were Appalachian sharpshooters, and he hated them because all they wanted to do was shoot British officers. And he hated that. He didn't think it was proper civilized war like all the proper countries in Europe fought, that being the English and the French, that is, and the Spanish. Washington wanted an army that would march out into a giant open field, stand in perfect lines. The front line would kneel down. The line behind them would step up. They would fire in sequentially and reload. And eventually, when the two armies firing at each other in this idiotic manner marched close enough and fired enough rounds into each other that they could do this, then they would fix bayonets and charge at each other like a bunch of barbarians. Now, that's the kind of a proper military that Washington wanted, where massive amounts of men are slaughtered while the general sits back on a hill somewhere and watches. Now, that's exactly what Washington wanted. That's what Baron von Steuben, or so-called Baron von Steuben, was trying to produce. And if you try to fight the British using those tactics, you will die. Because that was the tactics that the British had perfected. So why would you fight an enemy, a professional enemy who is the best in the world at fighting that method? Why would you choose to fight them that way? why wouldn't you choose the method of the other notable personalities who didn't go on to try to control government, Ethan Allen and some of the others, where their method was a true guerrilla-like tactics where they could hit and run, disrupt lines of communication, disrupt supply lines, rush in, steal artillery, get out. This is the kind of this is the way that you defeat a large, powerful enemy. You don't defeat a large, powerful army and a large, powerful enemy by taking them on nose to nose. That's a crazy way of fighting. Think about Afghanistan for a second. Think about how many empires have crashed against the rocks of the mountains of Afghanistan. And why have they done that? Why have the empires done that? Because the empires run in and they attempt to fight like empires fight, using the might of their massive armies. And the Afghan people welcome them with open arms. Oh, we're so glad you're here. And then as soon as they turn their back, they stab them. Or they hide in the rocks, and they come out of nowhere, and they strike, and they disappear back into the rocks. They live in caves if they have to. They live off the land if they have to. But they do not openly confront, because when you openly confront a superior force, you die. And so for that reason, Afghanistan, all the centuries, going all the way back through recorded history, empires go to Afghanistan, and empires lose. And that's... I can openly say that's a prediction. Okay, so anyway, so that's off the topic. I completely got off the topic there. I just spoke for like 12 minutes, completely off the topic with nowhere even near my notes. Okay, so I'll try to wander back and bring that back. Okay, so we fought the War of Independence, and we broke ourselves away from a central government with high taxation. And during the process of that, Washington, being influenced by the crook Hamilton and by Hamilton's puppet masters that controlled him, the bankers of New York and Boston bankers, those bankers influenced through Hamilton, influenced Washington to build up a massive debts that were absolutely unnecessary. In addition to that, the same people who were the bankers that were supporting Washington in this venture were also arms dealers that were importing really bad weaponry, that not the owned weapons of the Ethan Allen's men owned their own weapons, and the sharpshooters, the Appalachian sharpshooters that Washington hated so bad, those people owned their own weapons, but instead, Washington purchased weapons through Hamilton's friends, who overcharged them. Of course, there's always this relationship. It was like the Halliburton of its day. There's always this relationship between fascists and fascist government potentials and their arms suppliers, where they overinflate the price of the arms and then supply them into the military. So anyway, so Hamilton's friends were able to allow Washington and Washington's army to run up a massive debt. Continental Congress approved of it, and then the war was over, and all this debt was sitting there, and they had no way to tax to pay off that debt. Well, now they're going to dump that. They're going to try to find a way to dump that on to the citizenry. So the Articles of Confederation had worked perfectly well, except they weren't paying off those bankers, Washington and Hamilton's benefactors. So when the Continental Congress met again for the purpose of just tweaking and adjusting the Articles of Confederation slightly, many of them, and again, this has all been documented, many of them, when they arrived, they found out that they had been excluded from the meeting. And others that were not actually duly elected representatives of the Continental Congress were meeting behind closed doors, organizing a federal government. And it's a funny thing that they did meet behind closed doors, and there's no record of what they discussed. It was all anonymous. Well, it wasn't anonymous. We know who the people were, but we don't know what was discussed because it was all discussed without record. So they could say whatever they wanted off the record. And keeping in mind that many of the delegates that were sent there were excluded and literally turned around and went back home. So this was basically a coup This was essentially a taking over of the Continental Congress by a small group of people who were backed by the Hamiltonian Washington group. And so they brought the Constitution, and now there were good people who objected heavily to this Constitution, including people like George Mason and Madison and Jefferson, among others. They were very upset about it. Sam Adams was just livid over this. And so compromises began immediately. And the Constitution itself, at first, was only going to be the preamble. That was going to be the whole Constitution. And it left things so wide open that you could just pretty much do anything under the guise of federal government if you just stick with the preamble. So there was an insistence that they modify it. And in doing so, they came up with 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights. And these 10 amendments were supposed to take care of the problems that were inherent within the Constitution itself. Except they argued back and forth about these first 10 amendments, and they didn't ratify it right away. Most people don't realize this. The ratification process was set up in a way so that each state could slowly take as much time as they wanted to ratify it. And in doing so, it was kind of like they would have a meeting to ratify it, and if it got voted down, then it was still up for ratification. That meeting would cease. And then the people involved would talk among themselves and arrange another meeting when they could arrange that meeting so that the guys who voted no wouldn't be there. And they could just keep essentially kind of like gerrymandering, where they could manipulate who was going to show up to the meeting to the point of where they could control the meeting and have the kind of vote they wanted. And that was the process of ratification to get the Constitution ratified to begin with. And there are clear writings by the pro-Constitution people saying, oh, you don't have to worry about these things or those things in the First Amendment or the Second Amendment or the Fifth Amendment or the Ninth Amendment. You don't have to worry about it. Those will never be abused. We promise. And then, of course, those are the exact things that we have to deal with the government abusing that started with the very first Congress and the very first president. Are we seeing a pattern here? The very first president was Washington. And part of the problem was, part of the assurances given for people in order to sign on to this new Constitution was that the federal government would never be able to tax individuals. That was one of the guarantees. No, it's right in there. It's right in that Bill of Rights. The federal government will never be able to tax individuals. And so then what does Washington and the very first Congress do? They vote in the whiskey tax. Now, that may be a little vague for some people, until you realize that a good portion of the people in the colony, well, in the states at that time, a good portion of the people in the states used whiskey as money. It was a commodity money for a lot of people. So there were people paid in whiskey, and whiskey was used as a barter in trading. So if you tax whiskey, you tax income. You tax individual income. And it was entirely against the Constitution. It was entirely against everything that the backers of the Constitution had promised would happen. And yet it happened in the very first administration, in the very first Congress. So, let's get back to our original question. What part of the Constitution is it that you don't like? The fact that there is a Constitution. The fact that people believe that this Constitution could actually limit government. That is a lie. It's a con that was sold to people, and it was proven as a lie right from the beginning. But you know, people tolerate crazy things in order to maintain peace. Now, let me just read this preamble here, because I'm already way over time on where I should be on this. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. We, the people of the United States. It was not we, the people of the United States. It was a small committee that we're not properly elected, and we're not meeting for that purpose. That's a lie. It was not we the people. And as a matter of fact, my ancestors were living in eastern Kentucky and in what is modern day West Virginia and parts of Virginia, and they had nothing to do with this. They didn't elect anybody. They had no election of anybody that represented them in these meetings. They were entirely without representation. And that's my ancestors being of European descent. All of those Native Americans throughout the country and all those all the people of French descent that were living throughout western Kentucky and eastern Missouri and all up and down the Mississippi River, none of those were represented in this. None of the Native people were represented, and none of the African slaves that were held captive were represented in any of this Constitution. None of them had a say in it whatsoever. So how can it be we the people? How can a group of individuals who are connected directly to the banking industry be considered we the people? So what part of the Constitution don't you like? There's another part. Next, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice. How do you do that? How do you do that? Because it's not here now. I've talked extensively about justice and shown repeatedly that there is no such thing as justice in the United States of America. You cannot have justice. You cannot obtain justice by first going out and robbing people, paying for police forces, robbing people, paying for the court system, imprisoning people in juries without their consent, and not allowing them to leave that jury, not allowing them to opt out of that jury. That's slavery in every way. A jury in the United States of America in every way matches the description of a temporary slavery. There's no other way to look at it. If you refuse to go on the jury duty, unless the judge is nice and gives you a waiver, if you refuse to do jury duty, you can be imprisoned. If you resist that imprisonment, you can be killed. Now just think about that for a second. That's just jury duty. How can we have justice if money pays the judge and the same source of that money, which is theft, pays the cop, and the same source of that money, which is theft, pays the prosecuting attorney? All of these people work for the same organization. The judge, the prosecuting attorney, and the defense attorney, no matter who's paying him, are all authorized to be attorneys by the same licensing bureau that's recognized as a form of cartel by the government. There's a medieval term for it that I can't... Oh, a guild. It's an authorized guild authorized by the government, and all these people are a part of it. How can, with this kind of conflict of interest, and considering that all the money that supports all of this is taken through theft, through taxes, how can you establish justice? And again, I've said this before, if a person, we'll do it again, Bob breaks into Bill's, no, we'll do Jack. Bob breaks into Jack's house. Bob kills Jack in the process of robbing his house. Okay, so then Jack's widow wants justice. The police come out. They actually caught Bob red-handed. There's no question about it. In Jack's last words, he said, "Bob did this to me." Bob admits, "Yes, I did kill him." Or no, let's say he doesn't admit. Let's just say Bob stays quiet and utilizes his so-called Fifth Amendment rights. So Bob stays quiet. But there's no question of Bob's guilt. He's there. He's got the gun. The gun matches. Jack is dead. Jack has, in his final words, said Bob did it. Jack's wife witnessed it and testifies, yes, Bob did this. So the police come out. The police get there. They arrest Bob. Take Bob down, put him in jail. It takes, in American system, it takes a long time before this finally gets to a trial. for it to get to a trial, people are captured and enslaved to be on a jury. They're paid far below the basic wage that something like this would cost. And some people say, see, it's not slavery because they get paid. Well, guess what? Slaves were paid. All through history, slaves were given the basic stuff to live on. They didn't, you know, the current understanding of what slavery was is so far away from actual slavery throughout history that it's almost laughable. But slaves were always given enough to survive. You would always feed your slaves enough for them to survive. Otherwise, you wouldn't have any more slaves. So yeah, so the jurists get paid barely enough that the, like, what, $20 a day or some crazy thing like that? Come on. That's not a wage. That's a slave wage. And you don't have a choice anyway. It doesn't matter if they were paid $5,000 a day. If you don't have a choice, if you are forced to go someplace and do something, that's slavery. So we have the police working on stolen money, the judge working on stolen money, the prosecuting attorney working on stolen money. If the defense attorney, if Bob can't afford his own attorney, then the defense attorney is getting paid out of the same pool of stolen money as all the others are getting paid out of. Bob is arrested. Bob is taken to a jail. The jail is paid for by the same sources, the same robbery. Now, we go through the whole trial, and all the expenses of the trial are paid for by the same form of robbery. At the end of the trial, let's assume Bob is found guilty, and let's assume he's going to be given the death penalty. He'll probably sit on death row for 25, 30 years going through appeals, all of which cost money, before the state finally gets around to maybe putting him to death. And the whole time he's had free health care, he's had everything that he needed in order to survive comfortably provided to him through stolen tax money. And who has to pay all that money all those years? Jack's wife. And people living on the entire other side of the country who didn't know Jack, don't know Bob, don't have any involvement in any of it. They have to pay to keep Bob alive all those years and to try him and to try to bring justice to him. Now, how can that possibly be justice? And not only that, let's assume the state did find Bob guilty and decides to put him to death. Is that justice to Jack's wife? Who knows? Only Jack's wife can tell that. If I am harmed, no one can tell me what the value of my harm is but me. If I have a rare heirloom picture of my great grandmother, and it was the last thing that she handed to me on her deathbed, and then she passed away, and she was precious to me, and the only thing I have to remember her by is by that picture, and then that picture gets burned up in a house fire, there's no amount of money that the insurance company can hand to me that will make up for my loss. And you know what? The loss of somebody's spouse is far greater than a picture of your great-grandmother. So there's nobody in the world that can tell Jack's wife what justice is. Only Jack's wife can determine justice. No man sitting on a, no fancy person sitting with their robes and their fancy titles can ever come up with what justice is, except for the person who is actually harmed. That's the only person who has the right to say what justice is. So, what part of the Constitution is it you don't like? I don't like the premise of there being a Constitution. I don't like the arrogance of a small group of rich people who are connected to the bankers, who have a vested interest in making sure that the government is formed the way they want, then taking upon themselves the blessing of, but the title of we the people, speaking for everybody else. I wasn't even alive then. How can they speak for me? So that's a part I don't like. And then here's another part I don't like. It's to establish justice. That's the very first thing that we're told it's supposed to do, establish justice. And it is impossible for a constitution or any government based on the aggression of the state to establish justice. So what's my problem with the Constitution? Right there, buddy. Right there it is. All right, before I get wound up too tight here, let's break off for our commercial. 2 minutes, and I'll be right back with you, and then we'll get into, because I haven't actually done my notes that much yet. That was supposed to be just like a 5-minute intro. So when we get back from the commercial, I'll get into the real part of my notes. Thanks a lot, folks. How would you like to support badquaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from badquaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to badquaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help badquaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support badquaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do you do? Well, you go to badquaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from badquaker.com. Thanks, folks. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial, and I'm a little calmer now. It's nice having that commercial break in the middle because it allows me to kind of re-grasp my emotions and calm down and look at my notes again. Okay, so now I want to give a real quick disclaimer. As I've said before, when I'm talking about the inevitability of the police state, this is not cop bashing. I'm not talking about individual police or individual cops or their individual actions. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the concept that when you accept as fact that people can separate certain individuals out of society, give them titles of honor, magical clothing, items like this, and then allow them to behave in a way that the rest of society is not allowed to behave, then you set yourself up for trouble. And when you do that with a police force, you guarantee the inevitability of a police state. To better grasp, because I'm just throwing that out right now, but to better grasp what I'm talking about, I'll try to remember to put links on the page where this podcast is located. I'll try to remember to put links back to the first three in the series of The Inevitability of the Police State, and you can see more of what I'm talking about. In that series, what I try to explain is that it's not the individual cop that's the problem. Because individual cops or individual people on any level in government, or I also talked about corporations and how they function the same way, they have the same flaw built into them, the same flaw as police forces, the same flaw as government itself. It's built into corporations the same way because they're the same, ultimately the same design and the same concepts. So the flaws that are built in, humans react to certain stimuli. And economic stimuli produce rather predictable results. Now, not 100% predictable, but relative to a sampling of humans, certain economic stimuli will produce fairly predictable results over the long scale. That doesn't say that each individual will act predictably. But individuals will react according to, they will make decisions based on what they perceive to be in their best interests. So when you change, when you provide stimuli that indicates to them that certain decisions are going to produce a better result for them, then they're almost guaranteed to take those to react on to those stimuli. So once we start to understand that, then we have three economic stimuli that are involved in driving a society towards a police state. And I talked about those quite a bit in the first three parts of the series on the inevitability of the police state. I talked about self-selection bias and regulatory capture. Now, the third thing that I didn't really emphasize a lot was rent-seeking. And the reason I didn't emphasize it in the first three parts of that series is that I've already done several whole podcasts just on rent-seeking. And if I can remember, you know, I'm thinking about doing a YouTube on rent-seeking. So I don't know if I'll get that done this week or not. But rent-seeking, of course, real quick, is not, has nothing to do with what we call rent nowadays, rent-seeking being an economic term. Let me give a real quick idea of rent-seeking for you. Rent-seeking has nothing to do with a landlord or, you know, renting an apartment or anything like that. It is the expenditure of resources for the purpose of enriching oneself at the expense of another without adding goods or services to the economy. Now, this is different from theft. Rent-seeking actually destroys wealth. Well, theft just simply transfers the wealth. Let me give a couple of examples. Okay, so we have a guy in an alley, and another guy is walking by, and the guy in the alley jumps out, sticks a gun in his ribs, says, "Give me your wallet." All right, now, in a very technical sense, there might, you might consider this rent-seeking in the sense that the thief had to buy a gun, he had to spend some time waiting out in the alley, but typically that's not considered rent-seeking. Typically, this is just straight robbery. It's just a theft, and it's what you're really doing is you're just transferring wealth through the form of theft from one person to another. Now, this doesn't necessarily destroy wealth. It's just stealing it. But when you have true rent-seeking, now let me give you a scenario for true rent-seeking. Let's say an attorney's office decides that there's some a lot of uncopyrighted material floating around on the internet. So the attorney's office will hire, say, two or three paralegals with a decent amount of knowledge on how to do this, and they'll get on the internet and they'll just surf and surf and surf on the internet, and they'll get it on the telephone, they'll make phone calls, they will look up in legal books, and they will find productive people who are using material that they don't have the intellectual property rights to use. Now, these are, this is maybe small businesses. These are maybe maybe a blog, or maybe a forum or something like that. That's real. That's not making very much money at all. That's barely has enough advertising money to support itself. And these attorneys will, using their workers, their paralegals that are working for them, they will gather all the information, and then they will send threats to this blogger or to this small business on the internet or to this forum or whatever it is. They'll send them threats and say, "You're copyright infringing, or you're using intellectual property rights, or you're abusing intellectual property rights or whatever. And unless you pay us this amount of money, we're going to take you to court over this." And so then the blogger or whatever is forced to either shell money out of their pocket when they're barely making enough to keep on the internet as it is, shell out money to this this rent-seeking attorney's office, or fight them in court. And if you figure out that the average court battle on a IP thing like this can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars or even $1 million just to fight and be found not guilty, then it's often cheaper to just hand a few thousand dollars to the law firm and get them off your back. Well, that's rent-seeking. It's entirely legal in most cases, and it's entirely immoral. That's rent-seeking. Another form of rent-seeking is, let's say you've got some gangsters, and they they're working in one town, and they decide to expand their operations. And so two gangsters from the group are sent to a nearby town, and they spend a couple weeks, and they look around, and they find a very active nightclub. And so they go to that nightclub, and they watch it for a few days or maybe a few weeks, and they see what kind of business they're running there. And then one night they approach the nightclub owner, and they say, look, what you're going to need to do is give us 2% of your business. Otherwise, you know, anything can happen. There might be, who knows, anything can happen. You're a nice man. You're a family man. You have things to worry about. Things happen. We can help make sure nothing happens. In this form of intimidation, the businessman is forced to pay the gangsters a percentage of his profits. Now, the gang itself invested in this process. They actually sent the guys there. The guys had to live there. They recreated. They drank in the bars. They went from nightclub to nightclub, and they sought out a victim for this. In doing so, they used wealth in the process. So they're always using more, they're always using wealth in order to steal more wealth, in order to get what they get through extortion. So because the organization, because the crime organization itself is using up, is burning wealth just in order to extort wealth, then this is rent-seeking. It's not just simple theft. They have a whole organization, and they have processes that eat wealth and destroy wealth in the process of stealing from other people. All right, now we're going to get to the part about cops. When police forces rent seek, an example of that can be to set up a speed trap. You have a road, and you have an arbitrary speed limit that's placed on that road by a city council. It's not necessarily any kind of scientific basis. It has no, they didn't go and they ask the residents, hey, how fast do you want to drive through your neighborhood? How fast do you think it's safe for other cars to drive through your neighborhood? They didn't ask those things. The city council or the county or whoever just arbitrarily decided, this part of the street is 55, and then when you get to this one turn, as you come out of the turn on the other end, it's 35 for half a mile, and then it goes back to 55 again. And it just so happens, right when you clear that curve, that's where the sign is, and there's a nice blind spot there, and we can put a police car there. Now, when you have that, you have rent seeking. You have the actual expenditure of wealth in order to set the victims up, so that you can glean wealth from them, so that you can rob from them. You're not adding anything productive to the economy. Now, let's take police in a different situation. Let's say you have police in your community, and they're driving around, and they see someone driving erratically, or they see someone driving dangerously in traffic, or they see somebody clip another car and then take off real fast and try to get away from the accident. And so the cop pursues them, or the cop pulls them over, whatever the circumstances are, and the cop goes on through the other steps of the established law for that community and deals with it. Now, this is different than what I described a second ago. And most people understand the difference. Most people know that when a cop is on the street giving a guy a ticket because he's driving like an idiot, that's one thing. But when a cop is sitting at what's clearly a speed trap, and a city or a county or a community of some kind regularly makes money off that speed trap, most people understand that that's immoral. That's not right. You're not playing the game fairly when you do that. And the reason why is because that's rent-seeking. That's different than actually providing a service in traffic control to make the streets safer and so forth like this. That's the difference in what could be considered a useful service for police, whether that's private police or whether that's state-paid police or whatever, is not the point. The point is that could be argued as a legitimate service for police, whereas rent-seeking, being illegitimate, perfectly legal to do this, yet wrong, yet dead wrong, rent-seeking. It actually destroys wealth. It doesn't just steal from one group of people and give to another. It actually destroys wealth. It removes wealth from the community. Okay, so now that was the three things that I talked about. Well, rent seeking, what I just talked about, and then the other two things that I talked about in the series on the inevitability of the police state were self-selection bias and regulatory capture. Now, self-selection bias is, I'm not going to spend as much time on it because I'm starting to run out of time here without getting to my final point. But self-selection bias, I talked about, and again, this is offensive to some cops. I'm sorry. You know, lighten up a little bit and look at the thing and you'll see that I'm right. But there's the Andy and the Barney, you know, from Mayberry. There's the Andy and the Barney situation where the Andy type cop is very dedicated, very calm, very rational, very dedicated to what he's doing and smart and honest and all these things. And you have the Barney who is slightly neurotic, maybe dangerous, lives for the opportunity to get a little drop or two of glory, constantly wants to be showing himself off, boasting himself as something that he's, you know, more than what he really is. Now, with self-selection bias, you already have the work, the police work itself attracts two types of people, the Andy person and the Barney person. The problem is there are so many things within police work that hamper the Andy and reward the Barney and eventually push the Andy into lesser positions while bringing the Barney into more and more powerful positions. And you give this process a couple hundred years of working and you tend to drive the Andes out and you tend to create an atmosphere where it's less attractive for new Andes and it's more attractive for Barneys and the Barneys are rewarded to greater and greater extent. Now let me read something from 2000. This was an older situation that took place that's kind of been forgotten now. Robert Jordan, a 49-year-old college graduate, took the exam in 1996. This is the exam for a police work in, I believe, New Jersey. Took the exam in 1996 and scored 33 points, the equivalent to an IQ of 125. The New London police, I'm pretty sure this was New London, New Jersey, but I could be wrong. Maybe it was one of the other New England states. But New London police interviewed only candidates who scored 20 to 27 on the theory that those who scored too high get bored with police work and leave soon after undergoing costly training. So they're saying it's too expensive to hire people with higher IQs because after a little while in police work, they quit anyway and we don't keep them around. So why hire them and spend all the money training them? Now, the guy sued. And at first it went to U.S. District Court, and then it was appealed, and it went to the second U.S. District Court of Appeals in New York. And this is what happened. First, let me say this. The average score nationally for police officers on this test runs between 21 and 22. It's the equivalent of an IQ of about 104. And now that's about average. 100 is considered the average. 112 is considered the average college graduate. So if the average cop is hitting about a 104 on the IQ scale, he's about average, right around the average. So this is not saying cops are dumb. That's not the point. The point is that the best and the brightest have a tendency to be pushed out of police work. And this is a documentable fact. And when the U.S. District Court looked into this, they said that the city of New London had shown a rational basis for their policy. Okay, so, and then in the ruling of August 23rd, 2000, the second U.S. District Court of Appeals in New York agreed with the U.S. District Court that there was a rational basis for the policy. That means it was proven in court twice that indeed higher intelligence police are driven out of the work. And that's not saying police are dumb. Like I said, they're still average intelligence. Okay, now, what are the factors involved? Well, there's boredom. Being a cop means the vast majority of the time you're a cop, you're doing nothing. It's really, really boring. Boredom is, you know, this, and oftentimes, and I hate to say this, you know, I'm a heavy person. I'm well overweight. But oftentimes you'll see cops overweight. And the reason why is because most of their job is just sitting there in a car doing nothing. And it's mind-numbingly irritating. And then all of a sudden, they're in the middle of a situation where their adrenaline is just peaked out. For instance, and I've said this before, you know, you're just there doing the mundane police work every day, doing each thing. It's all the same. And then there's a moment where you're walking up to the back of a car that you've pulled over, and it's just like he's got a taillight out or something. So you're just going to go up and tell him, hey, buddy, your taillight's out. You might want to get that fixed. But as you're walking toward the front of the car, you see a little bit of movement inside the car. Now, here's two things it could be. It could be a woman on her way to the ladies' auxiliary, and she's got a kid in a car seat that dropped its pacifier, and she just reached down and picked up the pacifier and handed it back to the kid. That could be what you just saw. Or it could be a gang member that just reached under the seat and pulled out a pistol and is getting ready to pop you in the forehead when you walk up to his window. And you don't have any way of knowing until you walk up to that window. And that's what that cop is facing. So what you have is you have hours and hours and hours of mind-bleeding boredom punctuated by moments of exaggerated tension. And that's the life of a cop. Now that alone, just that one thing, take all the politics of being a cop and set them aside. I could do a whole podcast on how the politics of being a cop within police bureaus themselves, within the police departments themselves, politics drives the Barneys ahead and pushes the Andys out. I could do a whole podcast on that. But just this one thing with tension alone, that tends to drive, because the Barneys feed on that because of their personality. But the Andys hate it. Now, here's another thing to think of. Those A personalities, those Andy personalities, tend not to enjoy the common duty of the cop, which is breaking up domestic disputes. Nor does the A personality, the A cop, have any kind of enjoyment of undercover vice stings at the local strip club, or pursuing harmless drug users, or like just recently in California. They're busting the medical marijuana outlets it's a store. It's licensed. It's paying its local taxes. The state of California has authorized it. They're in there doing something that the community wants them to do. The state of California wants them to do. The people of the state of California wants them to do it. And federal cops are coming in anyway, full SWAT teams, guns drawn, literally throwing disabled people to the floor, and the Andy-type personality does not enjoy that. The Barney-type personality lives for it. So these things... Oh, and here's another one. How about the Amish farmers? How about the Amish farmers with their outlaw cheese? How many good Andy-type cops really enjoy going out and throwing an Amish man to the ground because he's selling outlaw cheese? See, but the Barneys, they love that. They love it. So this drives the Andes out, and it rewards the Barneys. Sorry about that. So now I've done all this podcast. I haven't got anything new on it. This is all just a recap that I was supposed to have done in the first 5-10 minutes of the podcast. I didn't even touch regulatory capture. I just refer you back to the series again on that one. Regulatory captures, where local police... Baggy. Baggy's trying to take over the podcast here. I'll read my note really quick for you so you get an idea of regulatory capture. Local government used to control the police by controlling their funding. As police generate revenue through citation and confiscation laws, the local government becomes dependent upon the revenue that's generated by the police force. When the federal money begins to enhance the ability of local police to garner more funding through citation and confiscation, the local government becomes subservient to the police. The local government becomes entirely dependent upon that police force and their rent seeking. And so this is how regulatory capture works. So no longer can the local government maintain and control the local police. They are producing so much of the income for the local government that the local government can't stand up to them. And this is happening on smaller scales and on larger scales all across the U.S. in all kinds of different cities. Now, one other thing I wanted to touch on, I'm right at the end of my time frame here. Radley Balco did a story on a guy, an Ohio resident, who was going across Illinois after going to a Trekkie convention. He was a Star Trek fan, and he was just horribly harassed, spent hours being harassed by this one cop who just decided for certain that he was going to find marijuana somewhere in his car, and he brought a dog out, and the dog was clearly... It was clearly not trained properly, and the guy was clearly not a good dog handler, and it was just a horrible, horrible example of exactly what I'm talking about. And then recently, and I'll put the links to all these, I'll put the link to Radley's article on it and the updated articles as they come out as well. And so now the police chief, after, a year investigation, something like that. I don't think it's been that long, but it's been a long time since this took place. And after all this time, the local chief of police, the investigation is all done, and he says, yep, we're good. We're doing everything the way we're supposed to do it, and we're doing it just like all the other police forces are doing it, and that's how we know we're doing it right, because other police forces are doing exactly what we're doing. Now, you can watch the video for yourself, and you'll realize really quickly that this is wrong. What they do to this guy, what they do to this motorist is wrong, and yet here's the chief of police saying, well, whether it's wrong or right is not the point. The point is, this is what everybody does. It's what everybody does. Therefore, it's okay. There's a police chief justifying his behavior by saying, it's what all the other police do. It's what all the cool police are doing. This stuff doesn't work on an individual basis. Why do we believe it? Why do we believe that this stuff works on a bigger basis? To establish justice. To establish justice. Now, you know what? You want to know what part of the Constitution is that you don't like? The fact that it's a joke. That's the part I don't like. The fact that it does nothing. It does not restrain government. It does not provide justice. It does not promote general welfare. It does not ensure domestic tranquility. It does the opposite. You can't have domestic tranquility when the police are doing what they're doing. You can't have domestic tranquility. And it's going to get worse. It's guaranteed to get worse because the economic stimuli will guarantee that it's going to get worse. I'm going to have to wrap it up with that. Folks, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com and be sure and get over to Bad Quaker's YouTube channel and check out our YouTube videos over there. And I'm going to try this week to put up another new one. Probably on rent seeking itself. So be sure and watch for that. Thanks a lot, folks, for listening. Goodbye.